film reviewer Graham Tuckett. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thank you. Long awaited, including by you, the Shia documentary, Beautiful Machine.
Yes, is came out last week. Now, firstly and up front, obviously, I've got to declare one of the most massive and overwhelming conflicts of interest I think it would be possible to have in this film. In that I am the author of the original script and treatment that the film was based on, and for the first 2 or 3 weeks, I was also the director of this film before I was fired. So let's get that completely out of the way. The film has turned out extremely well. I'm very, very happy with it. I went to the premiere last week, accompanied by Sam Peacock, who was the director, who took over the directing from me, and also John Toogood and Tom Larkin, the lead singer and the drummer of the band. We all walked in as a party and had a very, very good time. It was the first time that Sam Peacock had actually seen a final cut of the film. And it was the first time, I think, that at least one of the band members had seen a final locked-off cut of the film. I'd seen a version of it about 3 months previously when one of the producers sort of pulled me in to sort of have a look and tell him what I thought of it. And the version I saw last Thursday at the Embassy was a better film again than what I'd seen 3 months before.
Just before we leave your personal involvement, because I saw Sam Peacock quoted indicating that he had some experiences that made him understand what some of your frustrations might have been.
Yeah,
we are talking about what the old phrase "creative differences, frictions over how things are going to be done."
I think
with one or some of the people you were working with, or what?
My experience of the film was being pulled in about. It must be like 2.5 years ago now, being pulled in to meet with these two producers who said they were compiling a shortlist of potential directors for a New Zealand project. And I went into this meeting and found out the project was Shihad. I was riding a bit of a high on the, at the time with a Barry Barclay documentary I'd made, I think it was still in the cinemas. Confidence was high. I love the band Shihad, always have done for a long time. I can remember being a sort of 18, 19-year-old and getting into pub and getting into the Clarendon underage and watching them play. And very much my experience of growing up with Wellington has been very much their experience of growing up with Wellington as well. We are peers of that time. So I got extremely enthusiastic about the project, got awarded the job, and went away and sat down and did some months of research, during which I, not exactly uncovered, because, I mean, to some people these were very well-known stories, but got a lot more background detail on sort of 3 or 4 very sort of defining moments in Shihad's career. There's the obviously the great the name change from Shihad to Pacifier and back to Shihad again. Lots of people have their own theory on why that happened, but we actually, you know, to talk to the band and find out exactly what happened, what it was like to be in a band effectively named Jihad immediately after September the 11th, 2001. We also talked about the early days, how Carl, the bass player, came on board. Drink and drug problems that have racked the band, I think, for the, during their first decade of existence, and the way those were resolved. The career of Jared Dwyer, their first great manager, and of his very, very unfortunate and untimely death. The friendship and occasional conflict that the band have had with their peers, Head Like a Hole. Like, all of these came into, right, we've actually got the guts and the plot of a real movie here. Which was the movie we set about making. My vision for the film and the producer's vision of the film was sufficiently different so that we began to conflict fairly early on. And also, I think you had three very, very strong personalities all bouncing around inside a room. All of us very, very distinct ideas of how we wanted to do this. I was going through what I could only describe as the crappiest personal time, I think, of my entire life. Like, coming towards the culmination of what, with hindsight, was about a sort of a year-long or 18-month-long nervous breakdown. So my eye wasn't as on the ball as it could have been. And it just became the obvious thing for me to do was to say, look, I can't carry on like this. They said, we can't carry on with you like this. And I said, right, so I'm fired. And they went, yep. And that was it. Very little animosity, shake of the hands, and off we went. I passed on the script got passed on to Sam Peacock, who's made a terrific little short film, not a very big short film, actually, called Manurewewa, which I've always been a complete fan of. When I heard from the producers that Sam Peacock was the one who was going to carry on with the directing, and that he had the editor, Kushla Dillon, who was always one of my shortlist of two editors I wanted to work with, I went, great, this is going to be a good film. Something like a year and a half, 2 years later, it has actually turned out to be an extraordinarily good documentary. It's very, very insightful. The stories that were there in the original script and treatment have been excavated at probably an even deeper level than I was going to get them at. If I have any misgiving about the film at all, I'd say it's got less live music in it than I think a lot of people would expect. It's certainly got less live music in it than I was expecting. But at the same time, what you lose through not being a traditional rock and roll documentary with cutting away to the band on stage, which I'd always kind of envisaged, what you lose through, what you gain through not having that, is that it's a rock and roll documentary that talks to the partners, and especially the mothers and the father, well, especially the mothers of the band members. And that gives it an insight which no music documentary I've ever seen in my life has got. And I think that's probably the, that's the side of the story that I probably wouldn't have got anything like as well as Sam and Kushla have got.
Because you would have more music in it. It's very interesting. A listener very kindly once lent me Eric Clapton's autobiography.
Yeah.
Because I talked about, you know, loving Clapton, and he just thought I'd enjoy reading it. And I did read it.
Yep.
And there was basically no mention of music or songs or, you know, the whole thing was about Eric and what made him what he was, and he's fairly blunt about not being a hell of a nice guy for a long time.
Right.
And his battles with drugs and everything else, and that you could almost forget you were talking to a musician. So sometimes you can try and achieve too much, can't you, by trying to say, right, let's cut away now to this or to that.
Yeah, because you do feel that sort of weight of creative expectation of like, oh, we've got to cut away to the song. And I don't think I would have been able to overcome that creative expectation, and I always would have insisted on cutting away to the song. Whereas Sam and Kushla have, I think in hindsight, quite wisely said, no, no, let's stick with the family, let's stick with the stories, let's stick with the relationships. Rather than making a traditional rock and roll documentary, we're making a film about four young men and the families and the relationships, especially the relationship between the four of them that shape them. And for that, I absolutely commend them. It's a very, very good film.
Is that honest as well? Because, again, you're always dealing with egos, and I'm talking generically, and people's wish to control their own historic record. Is there an honesty in the way those things are traversed?
I think the band have been pretty brave about allowing themselves to occasionally look like complete prats on tape. There's a few stories that that I know we could have gone a little bit darker, a little bit deeper with. But you get to a point where you think, well, are we doing this for any great create? Are we? Is this philosophically justified? Or are we just being a bit tabloid journalism? Oh, look, shock, horror, scandal, groupie, drugs. The story of one of the band members' alcoholism is very, very thoroughly covered, as I believe it needed to be, because it was a defining part of the relationship, was how they were going to overcome one band member drinking to the point that was actually threatening the existence of the band. They're very, very honest and blunt about drug use, both of themselves and of some of their peers, and of the way that threatened to destroy not only their own band, but of bands around them. They're very honest about the drug use that was immediately behind the death of their manager, Jared. There's no shying away from the truth in that part, and it does make for a fascinating story.
It poses itself the primo and brave question, what went wrong, Beautiful Machine? Does it adequately answer that?
I think it talks about, it's not so much what went wrong as in, there was never a great Shehad, there was nothing that ever killed the band. There were two or three defining events that would have stopped, I think, a lesser and less well bonded group of individuals. The story of Shehad isn't so much that they've gone and made these albums or performed these gigs. The story of Shehad is that they've actually survived in this cauldron for 23 years. Like, no one in that band has ever had another job. That's all they've ever done in their professional in their lives since they were at high school, in the case of three of them, and very, very shortly after high school, I think, in Carl the bass player's story. This is all they've done. All their entire adult lives, their only full-time job they've ever had is to be the members of Shehad. So it's like, it's very much human life in microcosm, and Sam and Kush's film really does do that justice.
Okay, so noting your conflict of interest, I presume you're
massive
recommending
conflict
it.
Of interest, but without being in the slightest bit disingenuous, I really, really support this film.
2.5 minutes left. Do you want to do one, or can you sneak in both of your others?
Let's start with Kid with a Bike and see how we go, eh? Kid with a Bike is a 2011 Belgian film in the French language. It won the Grand Prix, which is the jury prize at Cannes Film Festival last year. It's a beautiful, beautiful little thing. Look, this is only about 85, 88 minutes long in running time. I think there's not more than four or five speaking roles in the entire movie. It's a story about a very, very troubled, about to become a Borstal kid. He's just been abandoned by his father. Of his mother, there is absolutely no mention whatsoever. He's been abandoned effectively to become a state ward. And he's put into a sort of quite leafy and idyllic, it must be said, looking boys' home, which obviously he hates. his only real connection to his dad is the fact that his bicycle that his dad had given him has been stolen on the same day his dad left. And he begins this fairly obsessive quest, firstly to look for the bicycle and obviously, you know, very much to reconnect with his father, who's now living in another part of town. He strikes up not so much a friendship as a sort of a very odd and dysfunctional maternal relationship with a hairdresser who lives in the housing estate, which is near the borstal that he's living in. And she agrees, somewhat against her will and better sense, but just because she's a good person, she says she can, you know, take him in and feed him and look after him for at least 1 or 2 days a week, maybe on the weekends. And so you've got this story of this very, very lost, horrifically angry kid, experiencing a couple of weeks in his life, which will come to absolutely define him as he slips into what looks like the very beginnings of a life of petty and then possibly far more serious crime. Gets at least one human relationship that he can rely on, and learns the fact that he can now rely on this woman to be there and do what she says she's going to do. And also does obviously make contact with the completely feckless dad and does get the bicycle back. It's a film that riffs very, very knowingly and very wisely on The Bicycle Thieves, which is the classic, absolute titan of European cinema from the 1950s, early 60s, 50s. It's just, look, this is just a smart, compassionate, lovely wee film. Well, well worth seeing. Is that long enough for you?
It's amazing how quickly you can wrap up when I start
waving your hands,
gesticulating
at me
wildly.
Yep.
Graham Tuckett, Kib of the Bike, he was reviewing there, and earlier she had documentary all about them. Beautiful machine, Graham Tuckett.